A number of our friends were very kind in their remarks about the series of class talks we gave on self-unfoldment based upon our book. So we decided to try another book and chose one which was written quite a number of years ago, which is itself rather dangerous in the field of science. But since the book was written, I've been watching moderately the opinion rising and developing in the field which the book covers. And while it does not seem as though a revision is indicated, perhaps there are some additions we can make. And in a case of this kind, I prefer to work with additions or new material as far as possible, assuming that those who are seriously interested in the basic text have either read somewhat on the subject or are in a position to do so. It seems, therefore, that in this first evening, we want to strike at a problem which has not essentially bettered in the last 25 years. More work has been done. Probably much more would have been accomplished if the field had not been restricted by its own basic concepts. Today, the trend is to substantiate as far as possible or to support the broad and prevailing attitude in the world of science. And to the degree that the scientist is orthodox, to that degree he must plod along very slowly, achieving little in his effort to offend none. This process is, in a sense, rather tiring. On the other hand, we know the danger that arises from simply plunging into an area unequipped or inadequately disciplined for the particular work to be accomplished. This, in turn, may lead to a series of wild guesses which have very little foundation in secure fact. Of course, our interest in the whole field is essentially philosophical. Therefore, we do not impinge too closely upon the sacred ground of the exact sciences, but we annoy them somewhat at times, and the tendency toward this kind of annoyance is increasing every day. So we want to develop certain themes and problems. Perhaps we can define one of our themes from the text itself, which carries a series of rather thought-inspiring references to the field under consideration. On page 126, I quote from a textbook of general embryology by Dr. William E. Callicott. And he gives us a few rather priceless gems. Quote, "The province of embryology is not merely thus to describe the upbuilding and unfolding of the structure and form of the new organism. It is further to describe the more fundamental processes involved in this development, and still further, to summarize these descriptions of both kinds in the formation of a simple general statements or laws." This sounds very encouraging up to the moment he has said almost nothing, but he has said it and very, very well. He goes on and gets himself into trouble. "This physiological aspect of embryology is concerned more with how development occurs. How and through the operation of what factors or mechanisms one condition leads to another. little break while I added a few personal remarks, and then we quoted the doctor again. In a way, this is also the why of development. Not why in the philosophical sense, of course, but the sense of how does it happen that these things occur in development. So he now explains to us that he is working on the premise of a how that literally includes the concept of why. But that the why, of course, is now to be understood in the terms of how. This gives you, perhaps, a little idea as to why great bodies move slowly. The situation, however, which we would like to discuss this evening centers directly in this how-why situation, because I think it reaches more deeply into the problem, a problem rather close to many of us in our thinking, than we have done in the book itself, perhaps due to the fact that in the years that have followed the publication, much new general information bearing upon the why of things has sort of come along and been stored away for such an occasion as this evening. First of all, most persons today have a fair knowledge of the actual phenomenon of the construction of bodies through a process called mitosis, or the multiplication of cells. We also know broadly that this continuing multiplication achieves the gradual building up of the various structures and parts of our corporeal constitution. We have a point on that, which perhaps might be worth mentioning. Quoted from Pearsall's Normal Histology. Quotation, according to Donaldson, there are 12,000 million cells in the cortex of the cerebral hemispheres of the human brain. These are all formed by the process of mitosis, which is a broad term covering the various phases of the multiplication of cells. They are all formed by the process of mitosis, and all before birth, so that nearly 12,000 million mitoses have occurred in the prenatal period in forming the cells of this region alone. That's a rather large piece of work. Now, science knows these things. Science appreciates the actual phenomenal process. But it has been able to regard this process for a long time without becoming, we might say, reverently aware of the tremendous mystery of universal law and procedure that underlies so complex a procedure continually going on and continually necessary in the development of all structures which we behold in nature. All structures, certainly, that claim any biological background. This brings us then to a problem of very great importance, and that is the pattern behind this entire procedure, which is now covered by the broad field of the concept of embryology and its related matters. The ontogenist is not too well equipped for this type of thinking, but it is inconceivable that he can completely ignore it. So let us see if we can some of the philosophical points that make this field tremendously interesting and spiritually a revelation. In the first place, all of these procedures in nature proceed according to a very simple and direct methodology. All of these processes are suspended from certain principles, and these principles in themselves are not especially numerous, nor are they as principles especially complex or difficult to conceive. Yet these processes in themselves, by their orderly emergence, by their continuance, by the inevitable fact that they set in when the situations and conditions are proper to the processes involved. This in itself and its related thoughts means a great deal when we try to understand life as a living thing rather than merely as an organism. How are we going to trace the principle involved in the perpetuation of organisms? How are we going to understand this process which causes a continual fertility in nature so that all creatures reproduce according to their kind and will continue to do so unless some circumstance or condition brings them to a sudden or gradual termination? Forms of life can perish, but usually the perishing of a form of life is due to circumstances disturbing the conditions which are necessary for the progressive continuity of that form of life. What do we actually have, then? We cannot assume that this process is unique or special or peculiar to any body or to any particular form of life. We are forced to the recognition that generation, as we understand it, is a universal phenomenon, that in one way or another, it is present everywhere, continually moving life itself, and that the presence of generation or fertility is not primarily due to the fertility of individuals, but due to a principle of fertility, which passes from generation to generation, does not originate with any generation, and usually does not terminate with a particular generation. This unfoldment or continuity of life, however, has a certain fragileness about it. It can end. It can terminate a species or a type of life. It can terminate in sterility, by means of which the continuity of one of the fine threads of this fertility can be destroyed. What do we actually have, then? We do not have fertile persons. We have fertility moving through persons. We do not have the right to assume that any individual generates his kind merely from himself. He generates primarily because of a power that is not his own, but in which he participates, and which is carried from generation to generation. By this same concept, which seems to be inevitable, and brings us to the simple primary point, namely that the generating principle is everywhere existent, and that creatures participate in it or of it, but are not primarily in control of it at any time. Nor is universal generation dependent upon any order of generated things. And nature, where it encounters peculiar difficulties in the perpetuation of certain forms or types of life, immediately readapts itself and produces other forms which are capable of surviving. Thus, we may begin our general consideration by the basic concept that we have an energy, that this energy is essentially a life energy, that this energy is like a stream or a river flowing from a mysterious source and extending itself over the vast area of the world, that this river or stream rises in a fountain of life essence, a fountain of what we are now more or less pseudo-scientifically inclined to refer to simply as energy. Energy, however, performs more than one function. And while it is true that in the process of generation more than one function is present, it is also true that the whole process of generation does not exhaust the potential of the area of this energy. Let us then assume again that perhaps we can use a tree to signify the principle involved, referring not necessarily to human beings, but to all processes of nature involving the formation and development and maintenance of structure by cellular chemistry or biochemistry. We then come to the idea that we have a root energy, that this root energy is essentially solar, cosmic, universal, that this root energy functions not only in our way of life, but in every conceivable way of life, where it is necessary for any reason to create structure, to create living tissue, to form bodies or vehicles for the manifestation of intelligence or consciousness. Out of this root energy, then, rises the life which maintains the entire tree. This life, perhaps, may be likened in its root to a seed. For we have the concept of a seed energy. We have the concept of energy growing in space. We have also the concept, which we can understand because we can observe it, that all of that which comes from energy, or which unfolds from the nuclear source of energy, all that is to come forth is archetypally contained within the seed itself, so that the oak tree, in all its glory and beauty, is locked within the acorn. And the unfoldment of the energy of the acorn must inevitably produce the oak tree. Thus, in some way, we have an energy that has a destiny, that this destiny is inherent in the energy, that this energy is a name which we have bestowed upon one of the great creative processes of existence. We therefore see, as in the case of the tree, that this energy will produce in its own growth a series of supports. It produces the trunk of the tree. It produces the great massive branches with their barks and their heavy fibers. It produces the very subtle buds of the tree. It causes the leaves and the small twigs to come. It finally brings about for this oak tree the recreation of the acorn, so that the life of the oak is consummated in the acorn which it produces, even as the oak itself grew from a previous acorn. Thus, in the process of the development of this energy, it is passing through consistent processes from its own natural seed state to the final production of further seed. The Indian, the Hindu, has this story in his wonderful symbolism of the lotus blossom, in which this lotus itself becomes the mystical symbol of the whole process of the perpetuation of life on all levels. Nature, in its curious and wondrous economy, working as it does from a comparatively simple archetypal framework, makes use of the same processes in the generation of other things. And we are now coming more and more to realize that consciousness, mind, all of the powers of the human being are in their own way fulfilling the same basic laws that in the universal energy field of space, there are the seeds of all things that can ever be manifested from space. Therefore, there is not only the energy seed which leads to fertility, but there is the mind seed which leads to thought or to reason. There is the psychic seed which leads to the perfection of the sensory perceptions and the aesthetic qualities. And religion has always taught that there was a spiritual seed arising in God, substantially and co-identically one with God, by means of which the consciousness of God as a seed is planted in the soul or inner nature of every living creature. Thus, the journey from the seed through creation to the production of the new seed is one of the great cyclic principles of existence. Man, in his own compound nature, therefore carries the power of this seed process. He carries it not only in the terms of the perpetuation of species, but in the generation of all of the psychic, mental, and emotional powers which he possesses. This concept brings us then straight into the main problem with which we are concerned. The recognition that the primary seed of being, of existence, described by the Oriental as a lotus seed dropped into the fields of chaos, that this seed, in its own proper environment or earth, which is space itself, vitalized by the spiritual equivalent of the processes of cell impregnation, by what the ancient mystics called the fiat, or the creative word, the power, symbolizing the active agent, that this seed, so impregnated, unfolds into existence, and that all existence is therefore the unfolding of the seed of being. Now, this is a large thought that has a great deal hanging upon it. Therefore, we must try to sense this as completely as possible. In religion and philosophy, we have this type of symbolism, but we have a peculiar phase of it which I think has defeated it in majority of instances. We think of this vast process, process as having occurred at a remote, almost incalculable period apart from us. That in the beginning, these things happened. And that in some mysterious way, from this beginningness, was created the universe. Also from it issued forth the gods as the creators of secondary things. From it came forth all the orders of life. And as a result, the worlds were made beautiful with the flora and fauna that developed upon them. And in the course of creation, according to religion, or in the course of evolution, according to science, this great area of fertility caused to emerge man represents, so to say, the extension of this process of enlivenment from a previous animal origin to the present human state. And beyond this, the possibility, not too well analyzed, that this process might produce in time a still superior type, something very difficult for us to imagine to be possible, considering the excellence of our present state. In fact, if nature doesn't produce something superior rather soon, we're all going to be in trouble. But the remoteness of this procedure and the concept that we have that it now represents a rather neat and tidy package, that the worlds are all here, that the things we need have all been created, and therefore that all we have to do now is permit these processes to continue as they always have, and we will either survive or else. And if we do not survive, the problem will no longer be of great concern to us. This, I think, is a static and false position. I think what we have failed to recognize is that this tremendous seminal or seed-like basic energy, bursting from the process of its own inception, is in itself in a process of continual growth. This is the point which has generally been ignored. We know that in the great tree, even though it may be a mighty sequoia, the tree must either grow or die. And in the universe, there is nothing finished. Energy must continue its own growth or die. Therefore, the procedures of the moving of a subjective energy principle into objective energy manifestation is continuous and perpetual and will exist until such termination is placed upon it as is inherent in its own archetype. And the nature of this termination we cannot even adequately conceive. We cannot conceive of the death of life. We can conceive of living things passing into the death state of their forms or bodies. But we also realize that the very moment a person or being is dying, another is born. And that in the great pageantry of things, organisms may cease, but the power which organizes, creates, or vitalizes organisms is itself, as the Hindus realized, the only immortal. Now let us try to bring this within some kind of a pattern of understanding. Let us imagine now that what we term energy, in its original state, is very much like the energy in the seed of anything, because nature is forever repeating its own processes. And that it is natural and inevitable in the seed to grow. And placed in a proper circumstance or environment, it will germinate and fulfill its reasonable expectancy. Let us then assume that energy in space is a continually unfolding plant-like thing, a living thing, far more than a plant as we know it, because it is a plant fully conscious of its own existence, a plant moving inevitably toward the fulfillment of an expectation which is inherent within itself. Now, what is the actual expectation of energy? We have to use symbolic terms. Perhaps expectation is not a formidable word, a word which could be defended in debate. But I think it carries the thing we are trying to put as simply as possible. The expectation of energy is the total expression of itself. The inevitable of energy is that it shall energize everything. That there shall be no air, no spot, no place, anywhere within the natural area of energy, which is not ultimately, completely, and fully energized. What would be the deterrent to this process? And the answer in the old philosophical system, of course, was that energy, so to say, has an adversary. Now, this adversary is not a real being. It is not a thing. This adversary is a space dimension, which the old Gnostics said was deprived of energy. Namely, that energy moves in a negative area or a negative field. And that this negative field is the static adversary which energy must overcome. Therefore, energy may be said to be continually bringing forth life. Now, as there is only one principle of life, and only one principle of energy, and only one principle of matter or substance, and this matter or substance itself is a condition of energy and exists only because the energy agent is already active in it, then we may say that the energy opponent, the adversary of energy, is a different condition of itself, because there is no other condition that can exist. Now, what is the other condition of itself? This other condition of itself is a degree of energization inadequate for the full expression of energy at any given time. Now, let us see if we can straighten that out and make it as reasonable as possible. Let's therefore go to the problem of a child growing up. Here is an expression of this principle. A child, we assume, receives a body This body is alive at birth, but not useful. In fact, it is perhaps the least useful of all forms of living structure, because the child does not develop even the power to preserve itself for a number of years. This body, though composed totally of living energy structures, is incapable in the beginning of manifesting the intellectual power within that body, the emotional power, and at the beginning can manifest very little physical power. This process of maturing a body until it is capable of serving as an instrument for a condition of energy was by the ancients broadened to recognize or represent the entire problem on all levels. Namely, that energy or life itself, in the eternal process of its own unfoldment, it depends upon something else. It depends very largely for its growth upon a reflex or reactive process of growth in substance. Now, substance is merely a condition of itself, that is, of energy. Energy expanding through substance is continually vitalizing substance. This vitality, in turn, results in the improvement of forms or structures, and this improvement, in turn, releases more energy. And the process continues on in a double-pronged process of growth. This process has as its final end that the form and the energy shall be exactly equal to each other, that there shall be no deficiency in form in its ability to manifest energy, and that there shall be no deficiency in energy for anything that form needs or requires. Now, if we can imagine this process occurring in space, we then have a rather interesting concept to begin something with. We have an infinite life moving continuously into this infinite manifestation. We have it flowing in all directions and in all dimensions simultaneously. We find the very processes of this making fertile the sleeping seminal content of matter, that this fertility causes matter to begin the process of fulfilling the laws of energy in matter by producing organisms. The purpose of these organisms is not their own growth. The purpose of all these organisms is that they shall rise to meet the motion of creative energy moving into manifestation. So what we commonly know as evolution is a more or less twofold procedure. It is energy moving over the area set aside for its own creative processes, and calling forth, as Burney says, from the abyss, from the depths, from the deep, forms gradually increasing in value, in refinement, by evolutionary process, to become instruments or vehicles for the manifestation of energy. Now, this growth contains one process that is a little difficult for us to understand, perhaps. Namely, that the impact of energy upon form is always shattering, because the form is never adequate to the energy at this period in the development of things. Also, we have to recognize that this energy moving into manifestations has a manifestation has innumerable conditions within itself. This energy appears to move outward in waves. like the tidal motion of oceans, or perhaps more symbolically like the ripples resulting from a stone dropped into a pool. The ancients were aware of the tidal motion of energy, which they called the outbreathing and the inbreathing of God. They recognized, as Plato pointed out, that the continual development of energy was according to certain laws or principles inherent in itself. What we therefore call the differentiation of species, the different levels of structure containing the various degrees of manifested consciousness which we see about us, represent the levels of the various modes of energy in the process of its own manifestation. Therefore, we have to assume that forms generated in various ways become instruments of a level or of a kind, and that wherever this level is reached, energy moving into manifestation produces level consciousness, level attainment, level growth, level specialization. As a result of this, in turn, we have an infinite diversity of the manifestations of a single energy. This comes then to perhaps one of the neatest problems that we have today, and one I think interests all of us profoundly, and that is the problem of heredity. Now, we have already attempted in the scientific world to understand the laws governing heredity. And we have created a situation which, scientifically speaking, is philosophically unsound. We have created a situation in which the unfoldment of life is placed in the fragile keeping of a dubious ancestry or a series of so-called accidental processes for which life has no adequate solution. This situation is not essentially true. It cannot be. It cannot be that in a universe governed by absolute law, a creature can, as a result of heredity, be born into a hopeless situation, mentally, emotionally, or physically. Nor is it possible for us any longer to assume that the child is the extension of the psychic energy of the parent by way of generation. Therefore, we cannot assume that the parent gives birth to the child. We cannot assume that the child is in each instance merely the extension of its ancestry. If we assume this, we assume a situation that is utterly contrary to the available facts that we can discover in nature. It is true that we are at a loss, and that we are further complicated by certain apparent facts which we have hastily accepted. Psychologically, we have accepted the importance of the transmission of characteristics. We find that a child born of a family with a certain type of attitude seems to be born with that attitude, or perhaps with a great repugnance to that attitude, but at least heavily conditioned by it. The fight as to whether the child's temperament has been modified before birth or subsequent to birth as a result of conditioning goes on. Most geneticists deny the concept that the parental nature can be directly inherited, but at the same time, they also assume that the new person, the child, is the direct product of its ancestry, that its entire nature originates in the ancestral pattern, and that consciousness arises as the result of an abstract psychological chemistry taking place in the area of inherited or hereditary characteristics, qualities, and substances. Now, this actually creates the ultimate state that the child coming into conscious existence is merely a consciousness derived from hereditary contributions. That regardless of how we look at it, this remains true. Let's take an extremely materialistic position. Let's assume, for instance, that we do not believe that there is any psychic heredity, that we do not believe, as the ancients did, that the child could be prenatally influenced by the emotions or thoughts of parents. And let us assume that the only part of this child's organism that is transmitted is the physical body. If, however, you take the scientific position that consciousness is a byproduct of the physical body itself, then the total being is the product of heredity. There is no way of escaping the implication. And in the total being is therefore the helpless production of something that has preceded it. The helpless progeny of parents who perhaps would give anything if the child was not like themselves. And are much disappointed when they see their own characteristics emerging. Why do these characteristics emerge? Let us then ask another question. If heredity is merely a principle involving the descent of fertility, then we have to recognize a very intricate philosophical principle. We know today something that we didn't know 100 years ago. The effect of the psychic integration upon bodily structure and function. We know today that our attitudes and our psychological integration, or lack of it, can affect the procreative power. So now the next generation is a byproduct not only of our chemistry, but of our notions. And we may therefore not be too surprised if it gives us a little worry. If the new generation is a little bit on the delinquent side, we now have the full explanation. It is a projection of our own delinquency. Now, this in itself seems to be poetic justice, but it is wonderfully interesting and intriguing, and just perhaps, that the parent should have the burden of a child whose temperament is similar to its own. But in all this situation, are we not a little hard on the child? Here we limit or condemn a creature to a situation which is only present because of the parental factor. And we also condemn this child with whatever imbalances and imperfections it inevitably has, to become in turn the rejoicing parent of future generations, so that this procedure will go on to eternity ad nauseum. We have here a breaking down and a defeating of the entire process of life. What we are therefore seeking is an explanation which will justify the known observed circumstances, and at the same time give the universe something more of integrity than the present explanation is able to confer. It is inconceivable to us that the universe could depend upon the frailty of man's increasingly neurotic temperament for the fulfillment of its vast and inconceivable purposes. There was a time, perhaps, when man felt that this was possible, that after all he was the noblest work of God. But today the thoughtful person hardly dares to say this, and at the same time believe deity to be a being of integrity or value. Now let us see what would happen if we took the attitude that instead of the parent being the origin of the child, that the parent is merely a bead upon a long thread which passes through many beads, and that the life principle of generation has an existence of itself, that it moves through the long, deep channels of created things, but is never identical with them, never bound to them, never dependent upon them, except in certain details. That the life that passes from one generation to another is not and cannot be, we will say, contaminated in itself by the instruments through which it passes. That this life is apart from and superior to the attitudes or conditions of any living thing. That the organism, be it human or animal, carries within itself continuously and inevitably this power to extend life into futurity. But that this power to extend life is a part of the psychic nature which cannot be contaminated by the attitudes or conditions of the person through whom it passes. That this life, passing through every form in nature, survives all forms, cannot be trapped or captured in any of them, ultimately, produces all conditions, but is itself unconditioned and capable of an infinite extension beyond any condition through which it passes at any time. This makes the perpetuation of the power to create form something entirely separate from the essential structure of human psychology. That this form is perpetuated as a result of the presence of an energy, a spark, a life principle, superior to and separate from any psychological, emotional, mental, or physical circumstance. Therefore, we can say now, this, assuming it to be true, still leaves us with a dilemma. If this is true, how are we going to explain that individuals may be able to destroy, or elements of sickness or circumstance may destroy the power of propagation? That therefore it is not inevitable that any being propagate, nor is it inevitable that life itself will break through obstacles set up to propagation and force it where either it is not reasonable or not desired? The answer is very simple in one point, namely that the process of reproduction depends always upon the available catalysts or polarities existing within the body or nature which is going to or should propagate. However, the failure to propagate has no effect upon the energy of propagation, any more than the fact that a wind blows a twig from a tree kills the tree. Any branch which is cut off from the tree withers and dies, but the tree does not die. Any form of life which is cut off from its energy supply will not perpetuate its kind, because it will not produce the necessary physical chemistries and physiological processes by means of which life can be reproduced. But this does not affect the continuity of that life itself. That life may or may not be in any way touched by this frustration of one twig or leaf upon the great tree of generation. It also naturally follows that in a particular instance, a structure for the perpetuation of life must derive its physical materials from the available biological supply, and that therefore the impregnation of the human cell and its development is associated with, as Paracelsus points out, the chemical and alchemical elements available in the organisms involved. There is therefore no reason to assume that heredity means any more than what it does mean, namely, the natural deriving of material from the only reasonable available source. That these materials may form a structure resembling in many respects the parental structure is because the materials are so derived that in the process of generation, not only is the one cellular structure involved, but this cellular structure mirrors the available energies, the available principles, the available substances derived from the entire structure of the parental chemistry. Thus, the newborn person may inherit certain tendencies of a bodily nature, may inherit biochemical disturbances which are likely to produce temperamental peculiarities. And as these disturbances were inherited with the substances from which the bodies were built, they may in turn react upon temperament, causing a parallel of certain dispositional traits. But these parallels are not always uniform or equal. And in all these different processes of generation, we must be prepared for exceptions, for these exceptions are continually occurring.